unfortunately, this campaign has been dominated by fear. Fear of communism on the one hand, fear of Fujimorismo on the other hand. And that's not, that doesn't augur well.
Welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Franz Ocilia, and today I'm joined by my co-host, Megan Rutka. Peru had one of its most consequential elections in its almost two-century-year-old history. While the results are not yet official, due to the tight margin of the race, Pedro Castillo is all but guaranteed to be Peru's next president. What does his election mean for Peru? Will he be able to deliver on his promises? And are the results of this election a potential trend line for future Latin American politics? To answer these questions and more, today we're joined by Michael Schifter. Michael Schifter is the president of the Inter-American Dialogue. He was previously vice president for policy and director for the Dialogue's Democratic Governance Program. Since 1994, Schifter has played a key role in shaping the Dialogue's agenda, commissioning policy-relevant articles and reports. Prior to joining the Dialogue, Schifter directed the Latin American Caribbean Program at the National Endowment for Democracy, and before that, the Ford Foundation's Governance and Human Rights Program in the Andean region and Southern Cone, where he was based first in Lima, Peru, and then in Santiago, Chile. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Thank you very much for joining us today, Mr. Schifter.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Now, on June 6, Peru possibly had one of its most consequential elections in its 200-year-old history. Keiko Fujimori on the right and Pedro Castillo on the left competed in the runoff election for president, and the only thing that they had in common was the large polarization that their candidacies created. So, to begin the podcast, could you please give our listeners a brief explanation about the state of Peru's politics and economy pre-election? What issues were the voters looking at?
Well, the overwhelming issue in Peru is the devastation from the pandemic. Peru has the very unhappy distinction, according to Johns Hopkins University, of having the highest per capita deaths in the world, doubling the number two country, which is Hungary. And this has really ravaged the country, the health system, the economy. Poverty increased by over 10% between 2020 and 2021. Unemployment has skyrocketed. And so the situation in Peru in the backdrop of this election was a very profound economic and health crisis, coupled with a political and institutional crisis. Last November, the country had three presidents in 1 week. They recently had a president who had been impeached. And Peru has long had pretty dismal, precarious politics. And every single elected Peruvian president since 1985 has faced serious, credible charges of corruption. So the politics was quite dismal. Aggravated by the pandemic, the economy had been doing quite well for a while, but in the last couple of years has slowed down, and really had been devastated by the pandemic in terms of the numbers of poor and the numbers of unemployed.
And Mr. Schifter, as you know, on April 11th, the first round of the election happened, and out of that first round came out Keiko Fujimori on the right and Pedro Castillo on the left. So could you please introduce our listeners to both Keiko and Pedro? Who are they? What are their backgrounds? And what are their politics? And most importantly, what did they promise to do if they were elected?
Well, both candidates, Pedro Castillo and Keiko Fujimori, first of all, were immensely unpopular. And over 80% of Peruvians, it's important to note, voted for either another one of the candidates, and it was a very fragmented field of about 18, 19 candidates, or voted in blank. So the two contenders on June 6 really didn't enjoy broad support from the Peruvian electorate. Keiko Fujimori, of course, is much more well-known. She's been around for a while. She's been a member of Congress. She heads a party called Fuerza Popular, a very right-wing conservative party, very much aligned with her father, who was a president who ruled autocratically and was accused of corruption and human rights violations during the 1990s and is now serving a prison term of 25 years. And she had run for president three times before, and she had lost. This was her third run for president. So she's run twice before. The last time in 2016, where she lost very, very narrowly to Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, but certainly sort of a well-known political figure, more on the establishment side, and promised continued pro-market policies. Claimed to want to tackle corruption, but really has some credibilities on that front because of her father's rule and also because she herself faced charges of corruption and still does, related to the Odebrecht scandal that originated in Brazil. Pedro Castillo was the real surprise just a few months before the election. He was not well known at all, had no connection whatsoever to the elites, Lima-based elites, either economic or political elites. He was a rural school teacher, a union organizer for the teachers, and came to some prominence in 2017 with a teacher's strike, has quite radical ideas. His party, which is called Peru Libre, has a Marxist-Leninist platform, and the head of the party is somebody by the name of Vladimir Cerrón, who is somebody who has been excluded from political participation because of corruption, because of his own history of corruption, and has a number of radical ideas. And what he promised was really to redress the profound inequalities and injustices in Peru, and accusing the economic model and the elites that promoted that model for several decades, since the 1990s really, of ignoring the country's overwhelming poor, not investing in education and health, and therefore really trying to tap into the anger and indignation of Peruvians poor. But he really is a campesino. He's a farmer, and I think we've never seen somebody with that background to go to a point where he seems to be very headed to be the next president of Peru.
And just as you mentioned, you know, by a margin of less than 1%, Pedro Castillo seems to have come out on top, although official election results have not been finalized completely. How did this result line up with pre-election predictions? And was this a surprising result for Castillo to, you know, potentially come out on top?
Well, I think it was a surprise. Although Fujimori is somebody who is Keiko Fujimori is a polarizing figure. She had very high negatives, what we call high negatives in the polls, and a lot of Peruvians, although they were not identified or support Castillo, did not want to go back to the Fujimori regime, which is more of the same that has really produced such a very, very precarious and difficult situation in Peru. So at the beginning, when after the April 11th first round, Castillo was up by a margin of about 11 or 12%. And Fujimori narrowed that margin. And as you said, and apparently Castillo has won by some 40,000, 50,000 votes, it appears at this time at any rate, because there was a real campaign of fear against Castillo and that he would turn Peru into another Venezuela. And of course, Castillo did the same with Fujimori, saying that Fujimori would return to the autocratic, corrupt rule and a government just for the elites and not for the poor, and which had enormous appeal among Peruvian population. So I think the surprise is really the Castillo candidacy. Again, somebody who had absolutely no connection to the traditional centers of power in the country. Fujimori was long predicted that she had a pretty good chance of getting to the second round. I don't think many people predicted she'd be president, but that she would get to the second round because she has her Fuerza Popular party. She's well known and she has a base of support, even though she has high negatives. So the sense was, for most analysts, was that she was unlikely to become president, but that she could, that she would one of the contenders to get into the second round. Castillo, on the other hand, just months before the April 11th vote, very, very few people, if anybody, really saw it coming. And it was only in the final weeks of the campaign that Castillo began to rise. And clearly, the word spread and his candidacy gained some traction among the poorest areas of the country.
If Castillo is announced the official winner, what do you think this will mean for Peru in terms of, do you think that Castillo will be able to carry out his agenda, fulfill his promises, and address inequality that, you know, he's promised to address?
I think it's going to be extremely hard for Castillo to fulfill his promises. This is going to be, I think, likely a very, very difficult governance challenge for Castillo. He has half the country not only not supporting him, but believing, convinced that he's a communist and that he wants to take the country in the path of Venezuela. So there's not going to be a lot of goodwill to work with him, to support him. Hopefully that will change if he begins to show signs of moderation and tries to broaden his team to bring on more pragmatic advisors. But clearly some of his ideas and proposals have scared many sectors in Peru, concentrated in the capital of Lima. And to govern, he only has a little over 35 seats in a Congress of 130. So, and he has an alliance with another party of the left, but that still doesn't give him enough votes to get through some of the more sweeping changes that he's promised in the campaign. He has made a proposal for a new constituent assembly, for a new constitution, but to do this legally, he really needs support within the Congress even to get that mechanism approved, and he doesn't have that support. Clearly, if he does try to do it illegally, which I think a lot of people fear, that would also create an enormous strong reaction. And it's very, very unlikely that he's going to be able to pursue that course very, very successfully. So I think the only way forward for him, if he wants to fulfill his promises, is to move towards greater moderation, to bridge the very profound chasm in Peru. And think about proposals that are a little bit less dramatic, and such as nationalization or confiscation, which have been out there in the campaign. He's been quite inconsistent and flip-flopping a lot in some of his ideas. But if he does, looks as it appears, becomes president on July 28th, clearly he's going to have to define himself. And if he wants to succeed, I think he's going to have to pursue a more moderate course and try to draw in experts, which will try to orient policies to redress some of the longstanding inequities in Peru, and try to give greater attention to neglected sectors like health and education, but also not completely alienate the business groups and other groups that he'll need to govern the country effectively.
You've mentioned, you know, the strong opposition to Castillo, and I'm wondering if we can dive into that, which groups in particular, you know, really oppose him, and what the reaction will be from these groups if he's declared the president. Can we expect just, you know, stonewalling his agenda, or, you know, what can we expect from the strong opposition?
Well, I think there are different shades in the opposition, and I think it's useful to think of the opposition not as a monolithic block, but as a group of different political forces, that some are more hardline and inflexible and will absolutely, you know, be in the opposition and will fight and resist any of his changes. And those, I think, represent people that are very close to the Fuerza Popular, the party that Keiko Fujimori leads. I don't see them becoming more flexible and really willing to work with the Castillo administration. I think that's a long shot. But I also see a lot of people who voted for Fujimori and would like to have seen her win on June 6th, but will recognize reality and will say, you know, let's be practical. Castillo is going to be president. And so do we want the country to explode, or do we want to try to make some changes that I think were overdue in Peru, frankly, and that we realize that this model is no longer sustainable. That started in the mid-1990s. It gave us some benefits, but it's reached its limit, and the pandemic taught us that. And so we have to make some serious adjustments and reforms in that. And I think that depending on how Castillo reaches across the aisle and reaches across the other side, divide of Peru, I think you can get some adherence. In the business community, he's already started conversations with the business community. For example, there have been some conversations with banks, with international banks, about perhaps increasing taxes on mining companies and just kind of redirecting budget priorities in Peru. And those kind of changes are, I think, going to be more palatable to some groups that are clearly in the opposition and voted for Fujimori. So I think there'll be different shades of the opposition. And if he's going to succeed, he's clearly going to need, may not ever get Keiko Fujimori to join forces and work with him together. That may be just too far-fetched. But I think it's conceivable that he can get others who now support Keiko Fujimori to say, listen, the Peruvian people have spoken loudly and clearly. They want change. And Castillo positioned himself as the candidate of change. And so they will respond to that and try to make changes while not completely destroying the system. And I think that's going to be the real test going forward.
Indeed. And earlier you mentioned how precarious Peruvian politics has been over the past 4 years with, you know, several impeachments or resignations. And I'm wondering if, you know, Castillo resigns or gets removed from office, do we know who could potentially replace him? Would there be a mechanism similar to the vice president in the U.S. where, you know, the vice president would take place in Peru, or is it a different system?
No, the vice president would take place. I'm not sure that the vice president would be acceptable to a lot of the people if he is impeached. And as you mentioned, the Peruvian president has been impeached, and impeachment is fairly easy to do in Peru in terms of not needing a lot of support in Congress. And the vice president would take over. That's how Martin Vizcarra became president when Pedro Pablo Kuczynski resigned as president under corruption charges. So the vice president would take over. The vice president is clearly very much in line with Pedro Castillo. So I think that if Congress wants to, I think Congress may not be satisfied with that outcome if they move towards impeachment. I think that we're in a situation where he is going to face enormous widespread opposition in Congress, and it's really going to be a test of his ability. And he has no political experience at all. He's never held public office, and so in order to build a coalition so that he can get things done is going to be a major challenge. I should mention that so far, although some retired military officers have made some noises that I think are of some concern, my sense, talking to colleagues in Peru, which I have been a lot over the last couple of weeks, is that the military is now, is supporting the constitutional order, is supporting the current president, Francisco Sagasti, and is hoping that there's going to be an orderly and peaceful transfer of power, whoever is declared president. So I think that the armed forces are so far acting according to the law, and one has to recognize that the possibilities of unrest are considerable. And so I think it's important also to watch very carefully and monitor how the military is likely to behave under different scenarios.
That is certainly important to be aware of as well. And Mr. Schiffer, now I want to shift the conversation to the Latin American region as a whole, because recently we have seen a number of left-of-center candidates and platforms across the region, with AMLO in Mexico and a potential Lula return in Brazil, and now Chile's new constitutional convention. And my question to you is, are these events and Peru's recent election results speaking to a broader trend in Latin America, perhaps a return of a pink tide 2.0?
I was even skeptical of a pink tide 1.0. I think identify certain shifts or tendencies towards the left, but I think what's more profound and more important in what's happening politically is simply the volatility in the region and the incapacity of governments, whether of the right or the left, really to address citizens' concerns and citizens' problems, simply not delivering. And so if they're not delivering, then people are going to look, logically, they're going to look for alternatives. And so I think if you can interpret the first pink tide largely in that sense. I mean, Chavez came to power, after all, elected in 1998 because the political and economic elites weren't delivering in Venezuela. And Venezuela didn't have one, but had two lost decades. That was true in Ecuador, and it was true in Bolivia as well, when we had new leaders. Not that those leaders really had the solutions, but they sort of did ride the commodity boom for a while. And so that's why they kept in office. Then they failed to deliver, and so people look for alternatives. And I think that's what we're seeing today. We're seeing that in Colombia, and we're seeing that in Chile. Colombia has an important election next year. Brazil has an important election next year. Chile has an election at the end of this year for a new president. And your people are, and what you have, what I think is happening is simply a rejection of the old order and the order and people in power who haven't been able to perform very well and respond very effectively to demands. And in many cases, that's expressed in a more leftist orientation. I think as you said, López Obrador in Mexico exemplifies that. But the real big story in Mexico, more than López Obrador, is simply the failure of the traditional political parties, both the PRI and the PAN, who had their chance since Mexico returned to democracy with Vicente Fox in 2000, and the governments have not been successful, and violence has gone up, corruption has spread, the economy hasn't grown, the poor haven't benefited, and the result was López Obrador. Whether he's going to be better or any better and perform more effectively, we'll wait and see. I think on a lot of these issues, he hasn't. And I think the recent elections in Mexico, the midterm elections, I think are very, very interesting because there was a pushback from the Mexicans saying, we're not happy with the way things are going. And also a greater demand for such checks and balances on his power as Mexican president. So it sort of goes, in different directions. But I think in the case of Peru, the Castillo victory reflects a profound discontent with the prevailing order and politicians. And Fujimori is, her father was the insurgent when he was elected in 1990, defeating Mario Vargas Llosa. Today, she's the establishment politician. And unfortunately, in Peru, elections provide opportunities to pursue new directions, to adopt new policies, democratic renewal. Unfortunately, the options that were produced on April 11th are not very promising in that regard. And I think what it needs to happen is simply to try to make the best of the situation if Castillo, it indeed becomes the president of Peru on July 28th.
And Mr. Shifter, this swinging pendulum in Latin America has always been really interesting to me. This dynamic between internationalist candidates and nationalist candidates from both the right and the left has always interested me in that sense. Because, as you said, a lot of people respond to failures of the system by electing populist politicians, either from the right or the left. But we also see that sometimes these populists also do not address the needs of the people. So along those lines, I want to ask you, how have the government failures in Venezuela and the And the sad story of Venezuela over the last decade affected how left of center politicians govern and how regional electorates view these more left of center politicians.
Well, you know, at one time when Chavez was in power, and especially the early years in Venezuela, you know, the country represented somewhat of a model, whether rightly or wrongly. I think that was true for the left in many countries in Latin America. I think the situation in Venezuela is not a model for anybody, anymore. I mean, the situation is just, unspeakably tragic and disastrous, and the country has been ruined. And so nobody, the vote for Pedro Castillo in Peru should not be interpreted that the Peruvians want to become like Venezuela, on the contrary. So, I think that though I think some of the, to just respond to your question, I think some of the center or right politicians try to learn the lesson of Venezuela in the sense that, you know, there needed the whatever you think of Chavez, he put his finger on some legitimate grievances that Venezuelans felt. Of course, he was a complete disaster in governing and as president and ruined the country. But he's put his fingers on legitimacy. And I think what the center right candidates need to learn, and I think some of them have learned this from the Venezuelan case, is that it's fine to pursue more internationalist, globalist, free trade policies, but you really have to pay serious attention to the social agenda. And you have to take seriously the grievances that people have for greater inclusion, for greater participation, and to convey the sense and to demonstrate that you're working on their behalf. It's going to be interesting to see what happens now in the case of Ecuador, where you have a very conservative former banker, Guillermo Lasso, who was elected president, who was behind in the vote to a candidate who was very aligned with Rafael Correa. Now he's president of Ecuador. And, if he's going to be successful, I think looking at the Venezuela case, I think he would benefit from the lesson, which is that you really need to be sensitive to some of the social inequalities and injustices that are in Ecuador. It doesn't mean he abandons his commitment to free trade and globalization and integration, but you need a combination. You need some sort of, you can't ignore the social question, because otherwise you're going to see a scenario like Peru, where it comes back to bite you. And it comes back to bite you in the form of a Pedro Castillo or somebody perhaps even more radical than Pedro Castillo in the end. So you have to figure out how to make these governing frameworks and models sustainable. And so I think that's partly the lesson of Venezuela, not to go to the extremes that happened in Venezuela under Chavez and then Maduro, but also to recognize that you can't ignore some of these injustices in the sense that people feel completely left out. That's not sustainable in this day and age, especially in the context of social media, the explosion of social media, and the people are much more informed than they ever were. You just have to take those realities into account when you begin to govern.
I think these have been great insights into how we can, view the past pendulum swings of Latin American politics and, potentially, politics beyond Latin America, and how we can sort of view and explain these pendulum swings. Now, we like to wrap up our podcast with a look towards the future. So first, what does a Pedro Castillo presidency mean for Peruvian American relations?
Well, I think it's going to be extremely interesting. It really depends whether he takes steps towards greater moderation. I mean, Peru has a free trade agreement with the United States, will he leave that free trade agreement? I think it depends who become his advisors, what his economic policies are. I seriously doubt it. I think that if he wants to be successful, and is serious about redistribution and addressing inequities in Peru, it's probably not going to be very wise to have hostile ties with the United States. The United States is not the largest trading partner. Peru's largest trading partner today is China. And I'm sure China will continue to be very engaged and will have a significant presence in Peru. But the United States is also important in terms of trade. And I don't think that if that Castillo breaks with the United States, it's really going to help him very much in what he wants to do, which is improving the lives of poor Peruvians. That's his overriding objective. And so I think, you know, it's hard to predict. It's, you know, he just came up from nowhere to now become the president of Peru. He's got to really clarify and define what he wants to do. And we're still in a period of considerable uncertainty. But I think what to look for is to see who he surrounds himself with, whether he breaks with his more Marxist-Leninist party and his mentor, Vladimir Serón, which I predict he will, and moves in a more moderate direction. And if that's the case, I can see that the Peruvian-U.S. relationship will remain on a productive footing. If he really doubles down and becomes extremely radical and breaks trade agreement and so forth, then I think there's going to be great attention and the relationship will become more complicated. So my sense is that the Biden administration will want to have a good relationship with the new Peruvian administration and will certainly be open to working with Castillo and his team, but will just remains to be seen what the main direction that the new administration will pursue.
And finally, and perhaps most importantly, what is your outlook for Peru over the next 5 years? Will Castillo be able to implement his policies, define himself, develop the political acumen to, you know, fulfill in his promises? Or do you think that Peru will succumb to the unstable politics of the last 5 years once again?
Well, I try to be, you know, I wrote an article I wrote an article in 1992. I lived in Peru for 4 years, and I lived in Peru when it was suffering hyperinflation and Shining Path insurgency. And I wrote an article in 1992 from Peru when everybody was pessimistic and I was optimistic. And so I guess I have, having lived there and having a long connection with Peru for about 35 years, I have certain faith that things will ultimately be okay. And I think that this marks a beginning of a new era in Peru. I think we've ended the period that started in the mid-1990s. Now there needs to be a new model. I think that the next couple of years under Castillo, and there is a big question whether he'll last. But if he does, I think it's going to be pretty turbulent, frankly. But I'm also optimistic that the Peruvians will work it out and come on a better path that will sustain growth, but also begin to address what's been neglected and an abandoned population in the country. So I'm optimistic, maybe the next couple of years, I guess in 5 years, more in the midterm, but the near term, I think it's likely to be pretty rocky and pretty turbulent. And I think, unfortunately, this campaign has been dominated by fear. Fear of communism on the one hand, fear of Fujimorismo on the other hand, and that's not that doesn't augur well for the near term. So I think it's going to be very, very difficult. But I am ultimately optimistic in Peru. I was optimistic even when it was at its worst period, when many people thought Shining Path could take over Peru. People forget that, but a lot of people believed that in the early 1990s. And so I have some faith and confidence in Peruvian people and in a very vibrant and resourceful society.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Mr. Schefter. We really appreciate you talking to us today.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.